it stripped me dry. There was so much water, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I was worried about my family, will they be alright? Will they make it on the island for another night?
Many nations around the world have incorporated human rights provisions into their legal framework and now provide more basic rights to their people than the United States. In key instances, international human rights standards are broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution or domestic civil rights laws. At this moment in history, the notion of applying a universal human rights framework to the United States seems to be striking a chord with activists around the country.
What do we want?
Human rights!
Where do we want it?
Now!
This is Ajamu Baraka, Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and you're listening to No Retreat, No Compromise.
International Women's Day has been observed since the early 1900s. In 1908, 15,000 women marched throughout New York City demanding shorter hours, better pay, and voting rights. The following year, in accordance with a declaration by the Socialist Party of America, the first National Women's Day was observed across the United States on the 28th of February. The second International Conference of Working Women was held in Copenhagen in 1910, where a woman named Clara Zetkin proposed that every year in every country there should be a celebration on the same day to press for their demands. The conference of over 100 women from 17 countries representing unions, socialist parties, and working women's clubs unanimously approved an International Women's Day. In 1913, following discussions, International Women's Day was transferred to the 8th of March, and this day has remained the global date for International Women's Day ever since. Since its birth in the socialist movement, March 8th has grown to become a global day of recognition and celebration. Hundreds of events occur, not just on this day, but throughout March, to mark the economic, political, and social achievements of women. This episode is dedicated to all the past, present, and future women warriors. In this episode, we not only celebrate International Women's Day, we'll also take a look at the continued human rights struggle for women with a statement from the U.S. Human Rights Network. First, we'll take a look at the current crisis facing thousands of Haitians and largely Haitian women. More than 30,000 Haitians are facing deportation. After four hurricanes devastated Haiti, deportations were halted, but resumed 3 months later. Immigration advocates are calling for a temporary protective status for Haitian nationals in the United States, as well as a continued suspension of deportations until the country can recover. Marlene Bastien is a dynamic leader in the Haitian community in South Florida. Not only is she a shiro to be celebrated this month, but she is also a leader in the effort to halt the deportation of over 30,000 Haitians. Marlene is the founder and former president and current executive director of Femme Haïtienne Miami, Haitian Women of Miami Incorporated. She is also one of the founders of the Haitian American Grassroots Coalition, an umbrella of 15 organizations that advocate for the rights of Haitian refugees. The network's executive director, Ajamu Baraka, speaks with Marlene.
We want to thank you, Marlene, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
We're going to, first for our listeners, can you explain to us this very technical sounding term, temporary protective status?
What it is, basically, is an administrative order that a president can sign to allow citizens of a country that has been either impacted by natural or political disasters to remain in the adopted home pending an improvement of their in-country conditions. That is TPS, temporary protected status. Basically, in light of the four hurricanes that destroyed Haiti for the past few months and then the ones that really had a devastating impact on the country, 2004, we are asking President Obama to award a TPS to Haitians, which President Bush, as we know, failed to do over and over again. We're asking him to do that right now, to really give TPS this protected status to the Haitians.
But at this point now, we understand that there's been a deportation process that has begun.
Yeah, there are orders of deportation. They are given to 30,000 Haitians who have been in this country for an average of 10 years. A couple of weeks ago, ICE, which is the Immigration Custom Enforcement, was trying to deport a woman, Yaline Jean-Paul, who has been here for 17 years, is married to a U.S. citizen, and has a chronically ill 7-year-old. Oh. And then we stopped her deportation at the last minute. And then these are the people that ICE is trying to deport, acting on rules that were set by the Bush administration.
Okay. Let's continue with that, with those kind of stories, because one of the things that we, of course, are focusing in on this month is International Women's Month. We just had International Women's Day on March the 8th, and many people aren't aware of how a deportation process like this and the conditions that that people face in Haiti, what kind of direct impact that might have on women. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, on the women here in Haiti?
Yes.
The women here, well, we know that many of them do have bag and baggage, which are called deportation letters. They are forced to live underground. And we know that in times of crisis and in times of hardships, women and children, and especially girls, suffer most, like, just like in times of war. For example, when we look at Sudan and what's going on right now, we know women and children are going through a tougher time than anybody else, and it's the same with these deportation orders. The women, they are forced underground, they are victimized and re-victimized again, even if they are victims of domestic violence, for example, or other kind of abuses, they are afraid to report it, and then they are forced to suffer in silence. So this situation, this grave situation, is having a very negative impact on the women and on the children, probably a life impact on the children, seeing their mothers forced to oftentimes sleep at different homes because they have to stay away from their homes to prevent early raids by ICE. So this really is a very, very, very difficult situation for women, worse for women than anyone else.
Now, if the deportation process went forward and 30,000 Haitians were deported back to Haiti, what would be the percentage of that population that will be made up by women and children?
Well, over 60%, because women made up over 60% of the population here in the diaspora, and it is about the same thing in Haiti. So women, our families have an average of 5 children. So just imagine these women living in fear of being separated from their children. This is like a slavery time where, you know, family members were separated. They were afraid. They didn't have any control over their lives. These women feel powerless, and they don't have any control of what could happen to their children. And we do know that as a result of the hurricanes that occurred in Haiti a few months ago, diseases are rampant there. Bridges, the entire infrastructure have been destroyed in Haiti. The crops have been destroyed. Famine is a serious issue in many villages, so these women feel powerless, and they feel like they don't have any control of what could happen to their children. This is a very, this is an impossible situation to be in.
What's been the response thus far from the new administration? Have you gotten any indications that there may be a reversal of the orders to deport?
What we know for sure is that it is being discussed at the highest level as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very encouraged by the fact that not having had access for 8 years, finally, we are able to speak to people.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a big change. So we are very hopeful by that, by the fact that the door is cracked up a little bit, hopefully. the door will be wide open. And our people who've worked here, because many of them worked for many years before their work permit and licenses were revoked, they used to be very active and contributing members of our community. So hopefully the door will be open and these law-abiding, hard-working individuals who've contributed so much to our country will be able to live free of fear, because no human being should be subjected to this kind of fear, the fear of waking up in the morning by loud noise and thumping on your door and being hauled up to detention centers in handcuffs, sometimes shackled, in front of your children, and then you haven't committed any crime. So hopefully the Obama administration seemingly is attempting to find a solution, and we hope that it is a solution that will be to the benefit of our people.
How would you respond to the argument that well, why should temporary protective status be extended to Haitians?
Haiti qualifies more than any other country right now.
And what other countries have received that status and when?
Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras. These are countries that suffered natural disasters in 1997. They are still getting temporary protected status as they should, because their countries were impacted. But no country has been impacted like Haiti. Haiti was impacted not only by natural disasters, but also by political disasters. So Haiti qualifies more than any other nation right now. And then the only reason why Haiti has not received the TPS so far is because we are dealing with black folks from a poor or less resourceful, because I'm not going to call it poor, from a less resourceful nation. That's the only reason.
No other
reason explains the denial of the Bush administration to afford TPS to the Haitians.
Well, that would seem to be the case, because as you just indicated, you said that temporary protective status has been granted to a number of nationals from various countries, rightly so, as you said, from disasters they experienced back in 1997 and 1998. But in the hurricanes, the last series of hurricanes just occurred last fall, correct?
Yes, yes, and then with Jeanne, which occurred in 2004. Haiti is still recovering from Jeanne. Jeanne occurred in 2004. Some of the villages impacted at that time are still underwater. So it is really incomprehensible, you know, and unacceptable that thus far Haiti has not been recognized. So we know that racism is at the root of the Bush's policy, and then we are really looking up to this administration, which is an administration for change. With a president, with the vision of President Obama, I'm pretty sure, I'm confident that he will find a solution that will be give justice to our hardworking Haitians.
As we close out this segment, what can our listeners do to help you in making sure that the Obama administration does the right thing?
Well, for now, we understand that the administration is really working on it right now.
Okay.
They are working on it right now. So we are asking our friends to, you know, give it or slow down a little bit for now. So we should hear something soon. We should
okay.
hear something. So let's give them a chance to work this out, because this is not easy. This is not easy. We know that the administration is facing, you know, a lot of challenges and obstacles. So let's give them a chance. If you talked to me a week ago, I would have asked our friends, listeners, to write and send emails. But for now, let's wait and see. Let's wait and hear what our president will do. We know that he will do something, and we are hoping and we are praying.
Well, we want to thank you for your very insightful comments. And we here at the U.S. Human Rights Network, we support the work, and we'll be watching very closely also, because we're prepared to spring into action if we need to, but we're going to trust your advice that we hold off and we listen and we see how things unfold.
At least until Wednesday, Ajamu.
Okay.
All right.
We want to thank you very much for your time, and we know that you're a little sick and you came out of your sick bed to join us, and we look forward to having many more discussions with you in the future.
And thank you, and keep up your great work, sir.
Before we end, as we celebrate International Women's Day, it is important that we highlight the continuing struggle for women's human rights. The following statement issued by the U.S. Human Rights Network on the occasion of International Women's Day poses recommendations for how the United States can demonstrate its commitment to the principles of universal human rights domestically, especially as it relates to women. The celebration of International Women's Day, which honors the social, political, and economic achievements of women throughout history, was tempered again this year by sobering global realities. Despite pockets of progress and scattered advances in women's rights, those remain the clear exception to the rule. The plight of women throughout the world stands as one of humanity's most enduring and shameful legacies. The statistics reveal a problem that is epidemic in scope. Women face the constant threat of violence, and not just in developing countries. According to the United Nations, one woman in five around the globe has been a victim of rape or attempted rape, and as many as one in three women have been subjected to some kind of violent act. Half of all women who are murdered are killed by their current or former partner. Violence against women has been reported in every international war zone. Women between the ages of 15 and 44 are at a greater risk of rape and domestic violence than from cancer, malaria, traffic accidents, and war combined. The global economic crisis has significantly elevated the risk faced by women, who constitute a grossly disproportionate majority of the world's poorest and most vulnerable citizens. Studies show that women are particularly exposed to violence when men lose their jobs or homes. Yakin Ertuk, the UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, noted on International Women's Day that, quote, women and girls in both developed and developing countries will be particularly affected by job cuts, loss of livelihoods, increasing responsibilities in all spheres of their lives, and an increased risk of societal and domestic violence. Human rights violations against women are further compounded by religious extremism, armed conflict, and patriarchal attitudes that restrict women's access to education, health care, and economic opportunity. The killings of women who dress the wrong way or dare to seek an education in Afghanistan, India, and elsewhere have provoked international outrage, but the systemic discrimination women experience everywhere is no less insidious for being less dramatic or visible. In the United States, for example, women in the Gulf Coast who survived Hurricane Katrina have encountered many of the same roadblocks as have victims of the Asian tsunami and other natural disasters. A 2007 report by the Institute for Women's Policy Research found that the percentage of women in the Gulf Coast workforce has declined since Katrina, and that women have faced discrimination when competing for higher-paying jobs. At the same time, women have been forced to shoulder increased burdens in such critical areas as child and health care. Most of the 3,000 licensed child care facilities in the Gulf Coast damaged or destroyed by Katrina have yet to reopen, and the region's healthcare infrastructure is still in shambles. Fixing these systemic ills will require profound, sweeping changes in both policy and behavior that will not come quickly. But the perpetuation of gender-based social injustice is intolerable, and the magnitude of the challenge does not excuse inaction. And while the U.S. cannot impose a more enlightened view of women's fundamental rights on the rest of the world, we can lead by example and demonstrate our commitment to the principles of universal human rights domestically. One important way to signal this commitment is ratification of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, also known as CEDAW. Of the 192 UN member states, the U.S. is one of only eight that have not ratified CEDAW, aligning itself with Sudan, Somalia, Qatar, and Iran. And Congress should ratify CEDAW without attaching various caveats, known as reservations, understandings, and declarations, that would render it ineffective or meaningless. In addition, the Obama administration should take whatever steps necessary to ensure that economic recovery policies are designed to include protections for women, especially those living in or close to poverty who need access to credit, social services, and a truly functional safety net. To that end, the administration should remove time limits under the Post-Welfare Temporary Assistance for Needed Families program that will otherwise result in the denial of benefits for thousands of women in 2009. Ultimately, sustainable human rights advancements for women will not depend on individual government policies or actions, significant as they may be. Discrimination against women reflects deep cultural underpinnings that are integral elements of patriarchal society. Just as the international community defined apartheid as an organized system of oppression based on racism, so too must the international community acknowledge patriarchy as a system of male domination and oppression that undermines women's rights on a global scale. Short of that acknowledgement, improvements will be piecemeal, inadequate, and reversible. International Women's Day reminds us not only of the immeasurable contributions of women to society, but also of the monumental barriers women must overcome in almost every facet of their lives. The very need for International Women's Day continues to underscore the distance we have yet to travel to fulfill the promise of universal human rights. Please join us next time as we speak with Pauline Park, founder of the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy. We will examine gender binaries and the need to expand discussions around women's rights and human rights to include lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people. We'll also move from International Women's Day to another international day in March, the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination.
Underlying all human rights work in the United States is a commitment to challenge a belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movement have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. Network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, disability, women's, workers, immigrant, LGBTQ, prisoner impunity, and other rights movements that stand to benefit perhaps now more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. For more information on how to join the U.S. Human Rights Network, visit us online at www.ushrnetwork.org. Human Rights No Retreat, No Compromise podcast is a production of the U.S. Human Rights Network produced by Ajamu Baraka, Sunyata Altenor, and Jean-Bierre Williams, with Sugar Matthews, Tonya Williams, Drina Brown, Kalia Kunu, and Rachel Fowler. U.S. Human Rights Network at www.ushrnetwork.org.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility.